Talk given Sunday, 8th January, 1978. One of the outstanding facts about the founders of the great religions is that they never produced a philosophy, a metaphysical system. What they taught was how we should live in order that one of the deep purposes of our existence as human beings may be fulfilled. What they taught was the meaning in the way of living the religious life, religious in its truest and its deepest sense. They taught us how we should live so that the psyche could be utterly purified, and thus the complete transformation of our mode of awareness of existence could take place. All the scriptures of the world are examples of such teachings. They express the way of life that has to be trod and the nature of the changes which take place in the deep states of consciousness as we awaken to the reality of transcendence itself, which means as we move towards what ordinarily we call the goal. These teachings, therefore, whilst having of necessity a certain logical core which does not affront one's rationality, are teachings which are difficult to understand because there is no language in the world which has words which can convey the real nature of transcendence. You can't talk about the infinite, about that which is beyond measure, beyond comparison, beyond all differentiating characteristics that we know of and experience. You can't talk about that, because all words, with very few exceptions, are limited to that which is finite, which begins, proceeds, and dies, which has relationships with other things. The words of our language belong to the sphere of mortality, not of immortality or eternity. Immortality and eternity are words which are beyond definition. What do we mean by immortality? It's no good saying you live forever and ever, for the very simple reason that the word live for us signifies that there is an opposite of living, dying. Death is the opposite. We come to an end, as we say. And this living and this coming to an end implies time, not eternity. Eternity is not a continuation of time, not the opposite of time. There is an absolute quality to it, which is beyond conception, beyond imagination. Whatsoever we say about a word like immortality is always less than the truth, and it always has a misleading element to it. Absolute is another such word. By contrast with that word absolute, there is the word relative. And it is the relative realm in which all the duals, or multiples if you like, are contained. Duals which know opposition to each other. Either irreconcilable opposition, or opposition which is resolved when we become aware of the situation in terms of wholeness, in which case we see the relationship between the opposites. To take a simple example, the North and the South Poles. In the days when people believed that the earth was flat, to go north meant to go forever and ever in that direction. To go south meant to go for an ever and ever in the opposite direction. When they discovered that the world was a globe, then the north and south poles became not everlasting opposites, but complementaries of one greater whole which contained them both. It's like that. So, in giving teachings which concern our spiritual life, language is often at a loss. Sometimes it has serious drawbacks. A system of philosophy is confined within the sphere of mortality. Every system of philosophy postulates this or that as fundamental axioms. And then it builds up a logical structure in order to satisfy intellectual curiosity. But a system of philosophy does not transform your mode of awareness from the mode of mortality, of the alternation of birth and death, into the mode of immortality. It does not so transform your inner consciousness that transcendence itself can function freely through you. Philosophy may inspire you, exalt you, urge you to live the good life in terms of a fine ethic. But you will always find that this ethic is an ethic which is limited by our own ambivalence. So, we still have the opposites, love, hate, cruelty, kindness, and so forth, operating in us. Now, there is a transcendental ethic which can come into being. This is one of the things which lies within the sphere of religion, of the religious life. It belongs to the context of transcendence, which can never be known fully, analytically, by the intellect, because the indispensable instrument of all intellectual processes, the brain, is a conditioned brain which cannot go beyond certain limits. That is why the brain has to become silent in the waking state in order to allow the sensitivity in us, which is pure mind, to remain unobstructed. And when that functions freely, we become aware in the mode of immortality, of transcendent reality. And that transcendent reality impresses and transforms the whole psychophysical organism. So do remember the contrast. Philosophy, science, art, even the finest art, all lie within the sphere of mortality. We do not break through the thorny bounds of the temporarily heightened or inspired states of consciousness. This is what completely differentiates religion and religious living from the worldly cultural life. Nevertheless, religion in the real sense subsumes all aspects of life, worldly and unworldly alike. It takes them up into itself in its transcendence. It is not away from these things, because it is only through these things, right down to the concretest level, that the reality of transcendence can make itself manifest. This is an important point to bear in mind. The infinite subsumes all finites. The infinite is a one only. You can't have two infinites, because then each infinite has become measurable, limited therefore, and then it is not infinite. So, within the infinite are subsumed the countless finites that make up our cosmos. Our psychophysical organism becomes more and more aware of separate finites. But if and when the psyche is utterly purified and pure mind can function freely through us, then in our deepest state of consciousness we can be touched by transcendence, and transcendence can function freely through us. That is how man ever came to know that there is this transcendent reality, by living experience. I want to stress very strongly this clear difference between religion and religious living on the one hand, and everything else that composes our everyday life. Now, whilst the scriptures of the world have concerned themselves with speaking about and suggesting the nature of transcendence, and particularly with showing how we may so live that from within ourselves we grow and transcendence is no longer obstructed by us, whilst the scriptures are primarily concerned with that, there is an implied metaphysic in each of them. And if you look very carefully, not merely as an intellectual examining the spoken or written word, but look into them through living the religious life in the deep sense, year after year, this metaphysic will become clearer and clearer to you. It is not a metaphysic that can be easily written down, because it is unlike all the philosophical systems that have been reared up through the ages. Nevertheless, it is there, and you'll discover one extraordinary thing, that all the religions, all the scriptures, have only one basic metaphysic, namely the truth. When we try to express this truth conceptually and verbally, we are hampered by our whole conditioning from the time we were born. Even when, through rightly living the religious life, our inner consciousness has freed itself from all its bondages and is aware of this transcendent reality, we discover that our power to express it is still sadly limited. Therefore, what we can do when we try to express this truth is to produce concepts and use words which are less misleading than those of the past. It is due to differences in conditioning and in the ability to express realized truth in concepts and words that misunderstandings and quarrels arise between the followers of various faiths. What is important for us is to see that the implied metaphysic expressed in differing forms in each of the religions is rooted in the one and only truth. Having understood this, let us quietly consider the important Buddhist doctrine of anatta, which is regarded as a teaching contradicting the Brahmanical teaching of the Atma. The word atta is the Pali form of the Sanskrit Atma. Anatta means not atta. This is not the same as saying there is no atta at all. Now, what was the original presentation in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads of the nature of the Atma? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya says, that great unborn Atma, undecaying, undying, immortal, fearless, is verily Brahman. And he also presents it in the negative form. That Atma is not this, not that, the famous neti-neti doctrine. The words this and that refer to all that we experience empirically as things or persons, all of which undergo birth, becoming and death. In the Chandogya Upanishad, Prajapati declares, the Atma, free from evil, ageless, deathless, sorrowless, hungerless, thirstless, that indeed should be sought. That is what one should desire to understand. Now let us listen to what the Buddha himself said with respect to his own discipline, which led to his full enlightenment, in his memorable autobiographical discourse, the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta. Speaking to his own monks, he says, so I, monks, being liable to birth, seeking the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana, won the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. The Buddha then repeats the same formula with respect to the unaging, undecaying, undying, unsorrowing, and stainless. But all these terms which the Buddha used, unborn, unaging, etc., are precisely the terms used by the Upanishadic holy ones when expounding or characterizing the Atma. Moreover, the Upanishads declared, as in the Tejobindo Upanishad, rest assured that not Atma, anatma, is a misnomer. There is no not Atma. So what else did the Buddha seek and win but the Brahmanical Atma, or in Pali form, the Atta? How comes it then that conventional orthodox Buddhist teaching rejects the Atta or Atma and entrenches itself in upholding Anatta, that is, not Atta? To understand this, first look at the significance of the terms used by the Buddha and by the Upanishads with respect to the Atta or Atma. Unborn, aging, undecaying, undying. But these are terms which are applicable only to that which is infinite, immeasurable, unlimited, to immortality, eternity, to the absolute, to transcendence. They are not applicable to what we call things, persons, events, moods, feelings, thoughts, ideas, and so on. Whilst the absolute or transcendence is unconditioned, free, and self-subsistent, all that comes in the second category is contingent, conditioned, and in bondage, in sorrow in its profoundest sense, in the actual dukkha. Now, are we constantly aware of existence in terms of transcendence or in terms of separate things and persons and events? In other words, in terms of unitary wholeness or of fragmentariness, of immortality, the deathless state, or of a succession of conditioned states, jatis, of freedom and nirvana, or of bondage and dukkha? We are all only too well aware of the answer, namely, that we are in bondage, in dukkha. We are aware, and we live every day, in terms of isolative self-consciousness, of unwholeness, that is, of unholiness. In rare moments, some of us have a glimpse of transcendence, the holy, and then we also see that what we in our usual state call the unholy is all subsumed in that holy. And that though we live and behave in our daily life as if things and persons were all separate entities, the separation is in our mode of awareness and not in the countless variety of manifestations constituting the universe, the one whole. Unhappily, that blissful glimpse of transcendence is soon clouded over because of our own imperfect state, our own unclean psyche. Unclean because of its self-centered grasping at everything that pleases it and its destructive aversion towards all that displeases it. So, we turn to religion and strive to live religiously. We practice certain disciplines. But we practice selfishly. Our object is to gain for ourselves the kingdom of heaven or nirvana or liberation. As long as we fail to ferret out this deeply hidden selfish drive in us, we are subject to our delusions and illusions in many shapes and forms. In the course of our disciplinary practice, and sometimes quite spontaneously, we experience an unusually heightened or profound state of consciousness. Because we are still egoistic and vain, still liable to delusion, we imagine that we have realized the supreme truth, the Atta or Atma, and are fully enlightened. Then the Buddha points out that this state, as well as all the concomitants of any such state, namely shape, feeling, perceptions, thought patterns, and discriminative consciousness itself, are not eternal, hence sorrowful. And therefore it is not fitting to say that anything transient is the Atta. Everything transient is an-Atta, not Atta. We have already seen that the term Atma stands for transcendence itself. Its context is eternity, the unconditioned, the one all-inclusive whole. The actual live awareness of such wholeness is not possible to us as long as we function in terms of fragmentariness, of discriminative consciousness which splits up the whole into separate entities, identifiable by their distinctive characteristics when observed through the activity of the senses and the brain. When earnest seekers of the unborn and undying, confined within discriminative consciousness, tried to understand Atma or Brahman as the primordial creative power which becomes the variety of manifested things and persons, those who could not transcend their separative self-consciousness referred to the Atma embodied in themselves as my Atma. They named this the Jivatma and regarded it as the personal, immortal, changeless, and identifiable entity which was their own ultimate self. This was their great mistake. They could not see that any and every identifiable entity is something which comes into being, changes in time and space, and perishes. Its context is not transcendence, immortality, the one only. The possessive term my Atma was the great mistake made by the masses. Even in several of the Upanishads, the Atma as being of the size of a thumb and as being seated in the heart is mentioned. In short, my Atma was a mannequin soul. This mistake in the Hindu presentation was complemented by the Buddhist fold, but not by the Buddha himself. Conventional Buddhist teaching confined, quite unwarrantably, the meaning of the word Atma to my Atma, to the mannequin soul. So, the Buddhist expositors regarded Atma as my Atma and the term Anatta to mean there is no Atta at all, instead of its straightforward meaning of not Atta. Perhaps we can now understand how this unhappy confrontation and confusion arose in the conventional popular conceptions of the Hindus as well as the Buddhists, and somewhat bedeviled the relationships between them. Here, let us restate the fact that the great Upanishadic teachers and the Buddha himself categorically affirmed transcendence in identical terms: unborn, unaging, undecaying, undying, stainless, sorrowless, free of evil, and as the one only. This supreme truth is the living heart of the implied metaphysic of the great religions. Now, what did the Buddha find around him in his own day? So much wrangling amongst the philosophers, and so little living of the holy life in a world full of suffering. To free mankind from suffering, he summed up his teaching in these words: cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. Those were his words. Instead of using the word mind, let us use psyche and say, purify the psyche, which may prove more convenient and helpful for our purpose at present. So let us first distinguish clearly between psyche and mind. Psyche is your psyche, your manifestation of mental processes which are specific to you. Your mental processes, your feelings and your thoughts are determined by the blueprint with which you were born, that is, by your particular brain structure and nerves and the activity of your ductus glands, etc., by your bodily health and state of being, your conditions and environment. In short, by all your conditioning. That is your own psyche, quite legitimately. Now let the word mind represent that universal form of energy which, interacting with body, the human body, gives rise to all the unique, separate mental phenomena which distinguish all the 4,000 million people of the world. We may now find it a bit easier to understand the situation. Say, purify the psyche rather than say, purify the mind. Because mind, the universal energy, is absolutely pure. It is of the nature of transcendence itself. And you know how in Zen Buddhism, mind is identified with Buddha and with the absolute, the philosophic absolute. So, there you are. We must look very deeply and carefully into these things and think clearly, free of mere brain chatter. Now it is said in the Jataka, based on the Buddhavamsa commentary, that after the enlightenment, the Buddha stared at the roots of the tree under which he sat for 7 days. How many of you are deeply interested in botany? However deeply interested you are, have you ever stared at the roots of a tree for 7 days and nights? If anybody thought you had, he might say something uncomplimentary. What is this tree? The Upanishads and the Gita speak about this tree, the Aswattha tree, unborn, undecaying and undying, the tree of life, having its roots above and branches below. Its physical expression, however, is the brain, the spine, and the nervous system, which does die with the death of the body. It is the concrete root, and therefore the instrument, which determines the nature of your particular psyche. All of you who are particularly interested in yoga should take careful note of this. The Buddha looked at the roots of the tree, the brain and its transcendent counterpart, divine intelligence. What happens to the brain when you are utterly purified, enlightened? 4,000 millions live on the globe today, but how many Buddhas can you find? If one looks at this brain and at this psyche which is utterly purified, and no one but an enlightened being can look at his own brain and psyche, he will be able to understand that this transcendent psychology of the purified Holy One is something utterly different from the psychology of sick mankind. An enlightened being is one who can clearly perceive the purified psyche, and he can also see the whole truth about each individual sick psyche. That is why the perfected holy ones are the true healers of mankind. Their healing power emerges out of a transcendent source. For 7 days and nights, the Buddha meditated on the roots of the tree of life. What did he turn over in his mind? This transcendent realization of utter purification, this utter realization of nirvana here and now, how shall it be presented to people in the world who are the slaves of their desires, their passions, their ignorance? How shall it be presented? Perhaps he was turning over in his mind how to apply this healing power of transcendent psychology to the sick psyche. Now, what did he notice in the functioning of the sick psyche, especially amongst the big names in the philosophical sphere of his day and age? He noticed the tendency to regard this, that, or the other state of consciousness as the ultimate, the final truth. And he saw clearly that what happened actually in that person was something like this. A person felt uplifted into an exalted mood whilst meditating. And he believed, quite mistakenly, that this was the supreme truth. But the Buddha knew that this was not the case, that this was not the Atma, not the unborn, the unaging and the undying, the sorrowless and the stainless. But because he knew that through the ages there had appeared perfected holy ones, great forerunners of himself, who had realized the Atta, and because he could clearly see who had become the fully enlightened ones, therefore he said, what you have arrived at is not Atta. This is devoid of unagingness, undecayingness, undyingness. This is what he said to all self-deluded claimants of supreme enlightenment. What these men had realized was not Atta. Now you have the meaning of Anatta. The Buddha was a practical man, a true healer of the soul. He clearly saw that a person who is ill, who is sick, needs healing. So, let's give him the actual medicine. That is, if he will take it. He taught that whatsoever is conveyed to us through our senses, whatsoever is put together, sankhata, made into a sankhara, a particular pattern, as we say, is not the integrated living reality. It is a mechanical synthesis of ideas, conceptions, beliefs, etc., all of which are not the truth, not the Atma, not the Absolute in terms of transcendent realization. So, shape and form are anatta. If you think that your body is reality and you say, this is myself, it is not so. Na me so atta. This is not the Atma, the Atta of me, declared the Buddha. Other people mistook their feelings and thoughts for the Atma. Even in the modern world, the philosophers talk about the soul, and certainly the orthodox conventional religious teachers, the clergy, talk of your immortal soul. This is not so. Because what is called soul by us and believed to be the soul is a conglomerate of our feelings and thoughts, and sometimes the mind. We use the word mind, and who knows what mind is? Can anybody who uses the word mind present mind like that? So the Buddha taught that all that we, constituted as we are capable of being conscious of knowing, as we say, not one of those things, including discriminative consciousness itself, is Atta. In the Brahmajala Sutta, he repeats this again and again after talking about the different philosophies of the philosophers. But the Tathagata himself, that is the Buddha, he who has gone thus and come to full enlightenment, the Tathagata knows that all these other writhings, wonderful word to use, the writhings of the feelings and thoughts of these people. But the truth is something beyond that, and quite different. It is sweet, wonderful, difficult not to be grasped by mere logic, profound, intelligible only by the wise. And the words wise and wisdom have no relationship to cleverness, bright-brained, brilliant, in our worldly state. This wisdom is something utterly different. This wisdom is your unknown unknowing, touched with reality. Your sensitivity which you cannot define, which you cannot see. This sensitivity which characterizes every living human being is the nexus, the focus point, through which, when the psyche is purified, transcendence flows freely. It is the pure mind, the Buddha mind, the Christ consciousness. Now, are we beginning to understand the meaning of this word, anatta? To talk of it as meaning there is no self is absurd. The English word self has a meaning which is correct and specific to us in our age and in our language and in our culture. It stands for this empirical, psychophysical, existential creature who is recognizable as that particular man, that John Brown, that John Smith, and so on. The name itself is used in that context. When we say I myself or you yourself, we refer to that temporal human psychophysical organism. That is what we mean by the word self. But self is a very unfortunate word, and soul too is a very unfortunate word to use in connection with Atma. So, if we understand how this word Anatta came into prominence in the Buddha's teaching, we can save ourselves a great deal of wastage of energy, and, more important, we'll save ourselves from going off the track. People say, root out the ego, destroy the ego. All right, destroy the ego. If you do succeed in doing it, which is nothing less than suicide, that is the end of nirvana and everything else which can manifest through you. None of us attain, realize, achieve transcendence. transcendence functions through us. How beautifully the Maitreya and the Skanda Upanishads put it. The body is the temple of the Lord. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. Your business is to keep the temple utterly clean, and then Shiva functions unobstructedly through you. That is how it is put. Or, as in the New Testament, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High? You will find all the great religions presenting the same sort of picture. So now, if we do begin to understand just what is implied, what is the meaning of anatta, then this purification work can proceed with great energy and proceed in the right way. That does not mean proceed successfully, in our meaning of the word. Neither success nor failure has any meaning or value in terms of the truly religious life, because the truly religious life here is the pure, transparent expression of transcendence, and not of anything which is limited and therefore can be compared. Don't let us feel or think, oh, he's further along the path than I am. Where is the path? What is the path? You yourself are the path. How can you yourself as the path be compared with anybody else's the path? The moment we do that, we have already blocked transcendence by separating thou and I. It's the same with the yogic teachings. Study your yoga Upanishads carefully. Look through them. You will find several passages which are just completely beyond understanding. Gradually, through the years, through the discipline, transformation takes place. And then you become aware, dimly aware, that something like this is not a deviation from the right path. You discover that the path is this itself, your own self, as it lives from moment to moment. If you see these things, you will cease to argue, to contradict. You know what the Buddha said, amongst so many wonderful sayings, I neither concur with the world, nor do I argue and speak against the world. Astonishing, isn't it? So, when one is like that, one is no longer separate from one's fellow man. Supposing you are the perfected Holy One, you see that this man is talking good sense and that man is talking nonsense, but you take no sides against or for the one or the other. You truly see, and by not taking sides, you are in complete communion with anything and everything, and therefore your influence everywhere is a healing, a whole-making influence, a purifying influence. This is the meaning of being a yogi. And you don't know that you are such an influence. It just naturally and spontaneously is so.